from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. You're listening to Skyfall by Adele, one of the Oscar-nominated songs for this year's Academy Award nominations. And coming up in our next hour, we'll preview Sunday's Academy Awards ceremony with a panel of experts, including film critics and historian Leonard Maltin. Which nominated films or stars are you rooting for? Post your picks and comments now on our website, kqed.org/forum, or on our Facebook page. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of the Forum program. And this year's 85th Annual Academy Awards has been rebranded. They'll be called simply the Oscars, and the host this year will be Seth MacFarlane of Family Guy. And the evening will include the usual awards in the usual categories, and will also feature a tribute to movie musicals of the last decade, as well as a celebration of 50 years of James Bond movies. How relevant are the Oscars today, and what can we expect this year? We're going to take that and much more up in this hour, and we have a whole panel joining us. I want to welcome back Cyril Wood, who's here with us, a studio freelance arts journalist and film critic who contributes to a variety of publications, including Hollywood Reporter, San Francisco Arts Monthly, and the San Jose Mercury News, and she's a member of the San Francisco Film Critics Circle. Welcome back.
Oh, hi there.
Hi, good to have you. Also want to welcome Ty Burr, first time he's with us. Glad to have him, film critic for the Boston Globe, author of a recent book called Gods Like Us on Movie Stardom and Modern Fame. Welcome, Ty Burr.
Thanks. Good morning.
Good morning to you. And we'll also say good morning to our friend Leonard Maltin, who is back with us on Forum, just spending this first half hour, film critic and historian and host of Maltin on Movies for the Reels channel, also author of the 2013 edition of Leonard Maltin's Movie Guide, which is now in stores. Welcome back, Leonard Maltin.
Thank you. What stores are left, you mean?
What stores are left, yeah. Listen, we just did a show on global warming, and it was grim enough to think about all the stores that are closing, adding that, but not necessarily because of climate change. You know, I want to just begin with you because you say there's no snobbery, if there is such a word, which I don't believe there is, going on here. But a lot of people feel that Ben Affleck was snubbed, that Catherine Bigelow was snubbed. And so I want to get your take on that.
Well, I just don't like the use of the word snub, because the snub implies an active sort of conspiratorial dig, like a blue ribbon panel got together in a room and said, all right, let's all snub Ben Affleck. Let's make sure Catherine Bigelow doesn't get an award. What happened, for starters, is that the Academy has expanded the Best Picture category. Last year and this, there have been 9 nominees. There could have been 10. It depends on weighted voting. So by expanding that category to 9, while remaining only 5 slots in the Best Director category, it guarantees 4 people are going to get screwed. Now, why it was these particular 4 people, I can't fathom. I admit that completely. It's a mystery to me. But the Academy, of course, never reveals its voting patterns, so it could have been a dozen votes here or there, in one direction or another, among the 9 possibilities or more from the Best Picture directors.
You still got excited about the Academy Awards, Leonard?
Sure. Absolutely. I mean, I don't love the horse race aspect of it particularly. I like the fact that it puts a spotlight on really good movies. And there are some people who feel that if the Oscars weren't there, that it's entirely possible that some movies wouldn't get made, that there is still a kind of a yearning, even among the money people who, you know, control the purse strings of the studios. They want respect, too. They don't just want your money. They want to get a pat on the back. They want a public acknowledgement that they've done something good, and that if there weren't something to shoot for, to aim for, particularly at year's end, we might not see some of the films we do. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's an interesting theory.
Well, there's also the theory that it is more about money than anything else, and that it's an award ceremony that's disguised as a show. And as a show, it can be, from some people's perspective, pretty boring, particularly about categories they don't care a lot about and reception acceptance speeches that they don't necessarily want to hear.
Right, right? Which to me says the Academy still has integrity, because if it was just if they pandered to just mass audience tastes, you wouldn't see sound editors and cinematographers and documentary filmmakers. The fact that they have retained all that means they're still true to their mandate, which is to honor the best work that is done by all the people who collaborate to make movies. It would be very easy to turn it into just a show the way the Grammys have. I mean, you know, the Grammys give out more awards off the air than they do on, and the same with the Emmys. But the Academy Awards, to their, as I say, I think to their credit, haven't surrendered to that. Now, it would make a lot of people happier if they did. Certainly a lot of, you know, just average, you know, television viewers would be a lot happier not to have to hear a speech by a sound effects editor or a makeup artist. But, I enjoy seeing those people get in the spotlight. I don't mean that the show doesn't get boring sometimes. Sometimes it does. But that's what it is. It's an awards presentation disguised as a show.
Talking with Leonard Maltin, and we've got clips from the movies, with the exception of Amour, which is in French, but we've got clips from the movies that are under consideration here or have been nominated. And, Leonard, I believe you're on record as saying Life of Pi and Silver Linings Playbook are great films?
I think they are.
Because
I think they're great.
All right. Well, let me be a little bit devil's advocate here, because I've read a lot of the criticism. We actually had Ang Lee on the program, and lovely man, and I thought the movie was beautiful and everything. But you get kind of a little bored out there on that raft, spending all that time with the kid and the tiger. And as far as Silver Linings Playbook, it was a feel-good film, a little bit of too much Dirty Dancing type stuff, some people said, and maybe just too feel-good. I mean, everybody in the film was nice.
They drag you through a lot of pain in order to feel good. I wouldn't call that exactly a feel-good movie.
Everybody in the film is nice, though. Even the ex-wife was nice.
Oh, please, this is about bipolar disorder. That's hardly what I'd call a feel-good film.
But the bipolar disordered people find each other and live happily ever after, don't they?
Well,
I don't want to give away the plot here.
That's what makes it a movie.
Yeah. So it's Hollywoodized.
Well, I don't know that some people don't end up with a happy ending, but it's a movie.
Well, let's hear a cut from that movie. In fact, we've got one here. And let me say that this is Pat you're hearing here is played by Bradley Cooper, who is bipolar. And he's reading his way through all the books his ex-wife, a teacher, uses in her class. And he's so appalled at the end of Ernest Hemingway's A Farewell to Arms that he rushes into his parents' room.
The whole time you're rooting for this Hemingway guy to survive the war and to be with the woman that he loves, Catherine Barkley.
It's 4 o'clock in the morning, Pat.
And he does. He does. He survives the war after getting blown up. He survives it, and he escapes to Switzerland with Catherine. You think he ends it there? No! She dies, Dad! I mean, the world's hard enough as it is, guys. Can't somebody say, hey, let's be positive? Let's have a good ending to the story?
Pat, you owe us an apology.
Mom, I can't apologize. I'm not going to apologize for this. You know what I will do? I will apologize on behalf of Ernest Hemingway, because that's who's to blame here.
Well, we got quite a performance out of Bradley Cooper and Jennifer Lawrence in that movie. And even, you know, one has to include De Niro. What about that particular passage? I mean, that's kind of a manic scene, really, where Bradley Cooper shows off his manic side, Leonard Maltin?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, he's a guy who's struggling against, he does not have control of his emotions, which is the whole point. And his parents, his long-suffering parents, are trying to be as supportive as they can. It's very challenging. It's very hard. And they do the best they can, but when they're awakened at 4 a.m. by a man, you know, ranting in their bedroom, having thrown a book through a plate glass window, it's tough to do. I mean, I think what makes this film exceptional, to my mind, is that it balances intense drama and comedy in the same narrative. You don't see that very often. I mean, they don't make fun of his problem. They don't make fun of the parents' struggle to deal with this problem. Or this other young woman, played by Jennifer Lawrence, who's got serious issues of her own, having been widowed at a very young age. But they manage to take these characters who are going through very intense problems, trying to work through them, and put them into sometimes absurd situations, even as absurd as a dance competition. And so it's not your everyday formula movie. I mean, I think it has something really unusual and compelling going for it.
Well, you also said that you liked and thought Life of Pi was a great film. I'd like to get your take on a cut from that film. Let's hear it.
I never thought a small piece of shade could bring me so much happiness, that a pile of tools, a bucket, a knife, a pencil might become my greatest treasures, or that knowing Richard Parker was here might ever bring me peace.
That's Pi reflecting on the shipwreck that left him stranded on a boat with a man-eating Bengal tiger, not exactly a everyday situation. Leonard, your thoughts?
Well, I never read Jan Martel's book, which has been very popular, as you know, around the world, so I can't compare it to the book. I was lucky enough to see it the AFI Fest here in Los Angeles at Grauman's Chinese Theater, which has an enormous screen in 3D, and I really felt literally drawn into the movie. They overuse that word immersive when they describe 3D movies, especially bad ones. But I really felt immersed in this story and in this adventure right alongside young Pi, and I went on a journey. I went on a whatever you want to call it, an odyssey with the character, and I found it very moving and very thrilling at times.
Leonard Maltin, again, famed film critic and film historian who is with us this morning for the first half hour of the program, and author of the 2013 edition of Leonard Maltin's Movie Guide, which is now in the stores that are remaining and have survived. Sarah Wood is also here with us, a studio freelance arts journalist and film critic, well-known certainly here in the Bay Area. And let's talk about a film that you didn't like, Sarah, and that was Les Mis. And in fact, let's hear a cut from it.
Yes, it's true. There's a child, and the child is my daughter. And her father abandoned us, leaving us flat. Now she lives with an innkeeper man and his wife, and I pay for the child. What's the matter with that?
At the end of the day, she'll be nothing but trouble. And there's trouble for all, and there's trouble for one. While we're earning our daily bread, she's the one with her hands in the butter. You must send the slugs away, or we're all going to end in the gutter. And it's all still after pay.
That's Anne Hathaway as Fantine singing At the End of the Day. More pleasant, admittedly, than listening to Russell Crowe sing. But you said this film is a mess.
Well, my feeling was after seeing it that the director should have been arrested for assault. It is, it is bombastic in terms of its volume and these huge close-ups, and it's just relentless. And I had a first-class migraine when I walked out of that movie. Admittedly, it's a really a good vehicle for Hugh Jackman, who's a song and dance man, essentially, and he gets to thrive there. But it was very long. I mean, it just went on and on and on. You just wanted the revolution to be over.
The best movie for you and so many critics is Amour that's on this list. We don't have a cut, as I said, from it because it's in French. Mick LaSalle, who another local critic who our listeners in San Francisco and the Bay Area know quite well, said it was a terrific movie but torture to watch because of the subject matter.
I mean, it is very painful, and I have to admit that I avoided looking at it, for I'd heard very good things about it. David Thompson, who's been a frequent guest on this show, I ran into him in San Francisco before I saw it. He said, it's the best film you're going to see from last year, and go look at it. And so I finally watched it. And I think it does, it takes a very difficult subject, which is, if people don't know what the storyline of it is, it's to an affluent Parisian couple. The woman, they've been together. It's a very long marriage. She has some form of stroke and really descends. The film descends from there. But it's a very sober portrait of something that I think just wouldn't get made in America this way. You know, the elderly couple would be cute, or it would be very melodramatic. It's got a very sober, I wouldn't call it detached, but and it does something, I think, that you really want art to do. It takes a very difficult subject, which is the old age, essentially, and it gives you kind of a catharsis. I'm not talking about redemption. It's not like Silver Linings Playbook. We don't have a rocky scene at the end with somebody winning a contest. But it gives you a way through with those feelings, and I think it's really an exceptional movie.
And you're not necessarily on board with Leonard Maltin about excitement, enthusiasm about the Academy Awards, and maybe even a little trepidation about Seth MacFarlane as the host?
Well, I maybe just a little more cynical. I do think that every once in a while, art and commerce, or merit and commerce, do intersect at the Oscars. But I think there's a tremendous amount of money at stake with who gets those awards. Directors and actors who win those Oscars can command greater salaries. There can be a real upward shift and boost in box office and DVD for films that win Oscars, or even films that are nominated. And I think that's what's driving the train.
Ty Burr, let's bring you into this. And again, Ty Burr is film critic for the Boston Globe and author of the recent book Gods Like Us on movie stardom and modern fame. Actually, you've said a lot of this year's Academy Awards nominees, at least for Best Film, seem to be sort of centered on history.
Yeah, it's unusual. Last year, we saw a group of films that centered on Hollywood history. You had Hugo, you had The Artist. This year, they're dealing with events that have taken place in real life. Lincoln, of course, the passage of the 13th Amendment. Zero Dark Thirty, which is quite controversially dealing with our adventures and misadventures abroad and trying to find Osama bin Laden. Argo, of course, recreates the rescue of six American embassy workers posing, hiding out in the Canadian embassy and escaping under the guise of a fake Hollywood production. And then, of course, there's, you know, Quentin Tarantino's version of history in Django Unchained, which is uniquely Tarantino-esque. But I do think what's going on here is the movies are, in a very unusual way, chewing over aspects of our past and serving them up in ways that we need to talk about and consider. And there's been a real discussion going on about what place historical accuracy plays in a movie that has been made for our commercial entertainment, what shortcuts you can make, what shortcuts you can't make. It's been a very, very interesting year and discussion.
Yeah, in fact, up in New England where you are, and particularly in Connecticut, there's been a lot of concern about those representatives in the Connecticut legislature voting in opposition to the anti-slavery amendment, because that's not the way it happened. And there's been a lot of heat brought down on both Spielberg and Tony Kushner, particularly because they want to put DVDs in the classrooms of the movie Lincoln, but also even about Argo. You know, it didn't end with, I don't want to give a spoiler here, but chasing Hollywood type of ending. Wasn't like that at all. And of course, the torture scenes in Zero Dark Thirty. I was fascinated by the way you set things up in terms of what you said is likely to win or probably will win, almost suggesting there won't be that many surprises, and what should win. In other words, take Argo. I think you think that will probably be the film that will win Best Film. And yet you said Beasts of the Southern Wild should win. And similarly, Steven Spielberg will win for Lincoln, and it should be Ben Zeitlin for, again, a movie you obviously like, Beasts of the Southern Wild.
Well, actually, I think it probably should be Ben Zeitlin or Michael Haneke or Catherine Bigelow, who's not even nominated. But, you know, getting back to something Leonard said earlier, you know, you don't want to think of it as a horse race, but in a sense it is. And really what the Oscars are, what the awards represent, is sort of a core sample of who of the cultural momentum at the moment the envelopes, the votes go in the envelopes and are sent off to the Academy. Who is sort of riding the crest of popular opinion within the voting members of the Academy. And it's funny to think that, you know, about a month and a half ago, before the nominations were announced, it looked like it was Lincoln's to lose for Best Picture. It's exactly the kind of movie that the Academy likes to throw Oscars at. It's good. It's good for you. It's historical. It's got the guy who's on our $5 bill brought to incredible life by a great actor. It's directed by a great director. It's written by a great playwright. There's, you know, it's like this big giant pinata of Oscar-ness. It's exactly what the Academy is there to pat itself on the back for. But when Ben Affleck was passed over, I don't think he was snubbed. I think what Leonard was talking about is absolutely correct. You've got 9 Best Pictures and 5 Best Director nominees, and somebody's going to get squeaked out. But there was a perception, and there is a perception, that he's kind of paid his dues. We're done kicking Ben Affleck around. It's a good movie. It's a popular movie. It's a feel-good movie. It's a well-crafted movie. And the momentum, to me, seems to have shifted toward, let's do something for Ben. Again, does that have anything to do with the actual final worth of which one is the best movie? These are all nine really, really good movies. Some of them are among my favorites of the year. I still think Beasts of the Southern Wild is absolutely unique. There's really nothing quite like it out there. I admire the sort of collaborative venture that brought it into life. I admire the actors who are not professionals. And it took me to a place that very few movies do. And that I would love to see awarded, but I don't think it's going to happen.
Well, let's see, excuse me. Let's hear a cut from that movie. This is a movie, of course, featuring Quejane Wallace, one of the youngest people ever to be up for an Oscar. She's all 6 years old when she played this role and starred in Beasts of the Southern Wild. Let's hear it.
All the time, everywhere, everything starts beating and squirting and talking to each other the ways I can't understand. Most of the time, they'd probably be saying, I'm hungry, I gotta poop. But sometimes they'd be talking in codes.
Is that one of your great movies, Leonard Maltin?
I think it's a unique and fascinating film. I'm not as much in love with it as some people are, but I have great admiration and respect for it.
And why are the Academy Awards, or why should they be given more admiration and respect, let's say, than, well, the Golden Globes, for example?
Oh, well, please, that's like shooting fish in a barrel, asking that question.
The Hollywood Press Association.
The Hollywood Foreign Press.
Press.
Well, I mean, I'm not in a bashing mood today.
A uniquely eccentric group.
It's a small, cloistered, deliberately elusive and mysterious group of people. That we don't know very much about.
But getting increasingly every year more and more attention and more press.
Well, they put on a great show.
Lots of alcohol.
Exactly.
Good speeches.
Bar. As a friend of mine said, much can be explained by those two words, open bar. But also remember, they have twice the nominees because they do a comedy category and a drama category. Plus, they honor television, so they get the star-studded turnout of the year. Many more stars than the Oscars can provide. So for the audience at home, you know, it's a bonanza. So no wonder they get a lot of attention. But no one, if you back them in a corner and give them truth serum, will tell you that they take it terribly seriously.
Any predictions before we say goodbye to you, Leonard?
The Oscars will take place this Sunday.
And more stores will close?
Wouldn't it be nice if that weren't the case? But hey. I'm living in the real world, just dealing with it.
Well, it's always good to have you with us, and I appreciate your
Thank
being
you.
With Sorry
us. Sorry I have to cut out early, especially with a great panel you've got.
Well, we're going to continue with that great panel with Sir Wood, who's here with us in studio, and Ty Burr, and you. In fact, let me invite those of you listening to join the program. We certainly welcome your thoughts about the Oscars, your thoughts about Seth MacFarlane hosting, your thoughts about who should win and maybe who's likely to win and who you're rooting for and all that, and questions that you might have. I mean, we've got a couple of people here who can probably answer just about any question you have about those performances and those movies that we're talking about. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, and you can join us now. Please feel free to do that. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. You're listening to Pi's Lullaby as we go into the break here. Another number of ways to reach us. You can reach us by going to our Facebook page or tweet us, our Twitter handle, @KQEDForum, or simply go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. But our phone number is 866-733-6786. We continue with Ty Burr and Cyril Wood. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny.
Thoughts are hazy, but this is one thing I'm sure of. Everybody needs a best friend. I'm happy I'm yours. You got a double, who brings you trouble. And though you're better without me, everybody needs a best friend. I'm happy I'm yours.
Well, that's one of the songs that's nominated for an Academy Award. It's written actually by the host this year, Seth MacFarlane, performed by Norah Jones. It's called Everybody Needs a Best Friend. It's from the movie Ted. A dreadful movie by this particular reviewer's sites, although I do like Family Guy and think it's kind of fun. Sarah Wood is with us, and so is Ty Burr on the phone with us from Boston. And we're talking about the Academy Awards and getting your thoughts about them and moving along here. I should mention, by the way, speaking about, I want to find out why Sarah feels the way she does about Seth MacFarlane. I alluded to that earlier. But I want to just give a plug for the fact that I'm going to be emceeing a local version of the Oscars, which will be presented in a live feed over at the Raphael Theater in San Rafael. And those of you interested can find out about it by going to the American Film Institute's website and also find out about a live auction they're having, which I guess includes lunch with me. That ought to be worth at least about $5, maybe, at the most. Talking, Sarah, though, about MacFarlane hosting, I mean, it's got to be better than James Franco or David Letterman turning, say, Uma, Oprah. I mean, but this is not what he does, really. It's a curious selection in many ways.
It's a little mainstream for him, it seems. He's got a little bit of a menacing kind of
edgy
thing.
Yeah.
Edgy thing. And there's something sort of hostile, vaguely hostile about him. But I think it's another bid by the Oscar show to attract a younger audience. And, of course, James Franco. I think James Franco and Anne Hathaway were part of that vain attempt, and that fell flat. So I guess we'll have to see. I wondered if I could just pull back just a moment and talk about the snub of the year. And that is Richard Parker, the Tiger, in Life of Pi, who gave, I think, one of the better performances of the year, and it's been completely overlooked.
Well, there were some other people who Ty Burr felt were robbed, mainly John Hawkes for The Sessions. And didn't you also feel the way about the actress in Rust and Bone, Marianne Cotillard.
Marianne Cotillard. Yeah, I thought, you know, I actually think that the categories are fairly well represented. I do think that there are, as always, performances that are really worth noting. John Hawkes has been nominated before. He hasn't won. It's a... on one level, it's a difficult role. On another level, you know, he just lies there. But he manages to convey the humanity of this character who's in an iron lung and wants to move out and have a full life in The Sessions without resort to the usual Hollywood melodramatics, although they're, you know, the music is doing its thing around him. But I think he gives a really honest performance and one that's really quite touching in real ways. And I would like to have seen that, you know, noted.
You were not, on the other hand, very crazy about Naomi Watts' performance in The Impossible, or for that matter, Jackie Weaver, who played the mother in Silver Lining Playbook.
I have nothing against Jackie Weaver. I think it's a good performance. Naomi Watts, I have trouble with that movie, which I think is a incredibly technically well-done recreation of the Indonesian tsunami of 2004. But it does sort of make it, as I said in my review of the film, does make it sort of look like a bad day at Club Med, because the film focuses on this white European family, which is not in itself bad, but at the expense of a lot of the locals. It just felt a little lopsided. And I think Naomi Watts is a very good actress, and she gives a good performance in the context of the film. It's technically quite well done, but it's hard to connect with some of the humanity in her performance and in the film. And I think that was, if I had to choose one, I think it's always kind of silly to say, you know, you don't belong, get out of the line. But that is the one that feels a little out of sorts for me, as opposed to Kavenjane Wallace, who, you know, I just saw that film again recently. And, you know, she's a 6-year-old, and a lot of people are saying, oh, she doesn't deserve to be there. But it's a real performance. You know, who knows, she's not drawing upon years of technique or acting classes, but it is a real created performance. I think she puts herself in the head of somebody who's not who she is. She gets into the spirit of what her character has to go through. And, you know, I don't mind seeing her nominated. I don't think she's going to win, however.
Well, Sarah Wood, I believe it was your considered opinion that the cinematography in The Master should have been nominated. And I think, again, you called that a crime that it wasn't nominated.
Yeah, I really think it was. And in fact, it's going to be shown in 70mm format at the Castro at the end of the month. If you haven't seen the film or you haven't seen it in that format, I think it is really sweeping, beautiful cinematography. It's better than the story. Paul Thomas Anderson's an interesting director, but he's not really good on narrative thrust. It's hard to know what that film is about, but the look and sound of it is beautiful.
Well, let's actually hear a cut from another film. I want to see if we can get to most of them before all of them except Amour, which we're not going to get to because it's in French, even though all the Francophiles out there will probably say, why didn't you include that? But this is a clip from Zero Dark Thirty, Jessica Chastain's character Maya trying her station chief, trying to essentially alert station chief to the fact that they need to focus on getting Osama bin Laden.
Someone just tried to blow up Times Square, and you're talking about some facilitator, some detainee 7 years ago said might have been working with Al-Qaeda?
He's the key to bin Laden.
I don't care about bin Laden. You're going to start working on the American Al-Qaeda cells. Protect the homeland.
Bin Laden is the one who keeps telling them to attack the homeland. If it wasn't for him, Al-Qaeda would still be focused on overseas targets. If you really want to protect the homeland, you need to get bin Laden.
When we talk about Best Actress, Ty Burr, it's your opinion that Jennifer Lawrence will probably win, although many feel that Emmanuel Riva should win, or for that matter, Jessica Chastain, obviously, as well as the other nominees. And I'm wondering why you're putting your money, so to speak, on Lawrence, particularly since, again, our local critic, Mick LaSalle, said she may have spoiled it for herself by saying something, in effect, about Meryl Streep didn't get the award at the Golden Globes acceptance speech.
You know, that was a joke that was understood, I think, within the industry. It was a reference to something that another actress said, and it was it didn't play well on TV. And I think Lawrence is unfairly getting getting knocked around about that. It was not a sort of I'm the king of the world kind of thing. It was ironically intended. That said, I think that I think she's going to win just because I think there's a lot of affection out there for her right now. She's a young actress who's proved herself in Winter's Bone, for which she was nominated, in a big blockbuster, The Hunger Games, and giving a really tricky but really well done, well thought out, fully fleshed performance in Silver Lining Playbook. I do think that there is a possibility that Emmanuel Riva could win for a variety of reasons. You have to remember that this is an award voted not by, you know, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, not by, you know, the general public, but by people who work in the film industry, and it tends to be an older body, and they do tend to like to reward older actors, especially when they may not have many roles left. And in a way that, you know, giving Emmanuel Riva the Oscar would also sort of honor the tradition from which she comes, which is challenging foreign film of the 50s and 60s and you know, the days when, you know, you would go to see a foreign film and it would really sort of re-scramble what you thought of the world. There's, I think, some affection there for her, and I wouldn't be surprised to see her win, but I do think that Jennifer Lawrence is the one that's probably going to take it.
And again, Ty Burr with us from Boston is the film critic for the Boston Globe and author of Gods Like Us on Movie Stardom and Modern Fame. And let me go to our callers, and we begin, Melvika, with you. Good morning.
Hi, Michael. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So I am personally a huge fan of Daniel Day-Lewis's acting on Lincoln, because I think he did an amazing job just incorporating Lincoln into his personality and displaying it to the audience. And I'm really rooting for him to win this particular award.
Well, thank you for that. In fact, a lot of people are rooting for him. It was an extraordinary performance, and he's an exceptional actor, by any lights. But, Sarah Wood, racking up that many Oscars presents, in some people's minds, perhaps an impediment.
Well, he might be. If he does win, I think he'll be the first person to win three best actors in a row. The thing is, I just wish it had been in a better film, and I know it's kind of heresy to say this about Lincoln, but it was a very earnest and well-intentioned effort that, in my opinion, really played like something you'd see on the History Channel. They were very concerned about accuracy. They're still getting casticated, even though I think that they were really conscientious about this for not being completely accurate.
I can tell you this. Knowing Tony Kushner many, many years and knew him when he was working on that script, and it was a extraordinary effort as far as the research side of things, I know personally.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and yet getting Connecticut wrong, I mean, they're fired up about that, though, up there in Connecticut, Tiber, aren't they?
One guy, Joe Courtney, the congressman, is very, very fired up about it. And he has been holding Tony Kushner's feet to the fire. And Tony Kushner did sort of admit, yeah, we kind of changed that because we wanted to make it more dramatic. We wanted to, you know, we wanted to have the congressman vote according to state, even though that's not what happened in real life, because it gives the audience more of a handhold, more of a, you know, structure to the scene. So, you know, personally, I don't think they should change it for the DVD. I do agree that I don't think Lincoln is a perfect film. My issues are with the more Spielbergian moments of it when, you know, you can feel the machinery start cranking Lincoln up to the heavens and John Williams' music starts kicking in. And it's a bad History Channel documentary at that point. But I do think that I don't have a problem with all the talk because it's Tony Kushner talk and it's so well done, and the actors just bite into it, and I could just listen to it all day.
I got to tell you, I thought Tommy Lee Jones was terrific. I mean, he had the best lines in the script as Thaddeus Stevens, but I think if I'm reading you correctly, Tiber, you thought it should have gone to Christoph Waltz for his role in Django Unchained.
No, not necessarily. I think those are all good performances. I think Tommy Lee Jones is going to win it because the role fits in with Tommy Lee Jones' persona as this great curmudgeon of an actor out there. He's also sort of the moral center of the movie even more than Lincoln is. Even before you get to the big reveal scene at the end, which I won't give away if you haven't seen the film, it tells you something about Thaddeus Stevens that you didn't know. I think that it's an interesting category, Best Supporting Actor. All the actors in it have won Oscars before.
Well, if Sally Field wins again, you can rest assured she's not going to say, "You like me, you really like me."
No, but she might refer to it. I think, you know, Christoph Waltz is wonderful, though some people probably think that he's doing a flip side version of what he did in Inglourious Basterds. I think Philip Seymour Hoffman, well, he doesn't even belong in this category. He belongs in Best Actor.
I totally agree. Yeah.
And it's a much subtler performance than what Joaquin Phoenix is doing on purpose, but it's there's so much there.
Let's we've been talking about Lincoln a good deal. I want to hear a little cut from there. It's, again, starring Daniel Day-Lewis. In this picture is, as Sarah said, I believe, was getting some of the major buzz. Now it's starting to be more Argo, but let's hear.
We can't tell our people they can vote yes on abolishing slavery unless at the same time we can tell them that you're seeking a negotiated peace.
It's either the amendment or this Confederate peace. You cannot have both.
How many hundreds of thousands have died during your administration?
Congress must never declare equal those whom God created unequal.
Leave the Constitution alone.
We are stepped out upon the world stage now, with the fate of human dignity in our hands. Blood's been spilled to afford us this moment. Now, now, now.
And a lot of listeners weighing in, of course. I want to hear from some of you. David from San Jose just called to say the French film Rust and Bone is the best movie, and aside from Marion Cotillard's nomination, that was overlooked by the Oscars. Let's hear from more of you. Peter, hi.
Hi. I thought Life of Pi twice. I never see movies twice. I went back and thought I enjoyed it more the second time. It's got the elements of spirituality, visual surprises, visual stunning, effects, and it's such an adventure. So I can't say enough about that. The way the boy dives into the three great spiritual traditions of course, his own Krishna tradition, and then Islam and Christianity, all experimenting at the same time as a youth, was just great. And actually, what I remembered so much about it was when he prays and he's going to bed and he says, "Thank you, Krishna, for leading me to Christ." That was just so touching, and it's I think it's important, and it's also indicative of our global evolution. And I wanted to mention Flight because it deals with addiction and denial, alcohol and drugs, and people's ability to convince themselves they can function normally and responsibly under the influence. And I just think that's so important. I was just proud of those filmmakers and the actor to do it.
Thank you, Peter. Good
Thank
to
you.
Hear from you this morning. And let me just go on and hear from some more listeners. Danny, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to ask you guys what you thought about Cloud Atlas not being nominated for any Oscars, or whether that was a good choice or a bad movie that got snubbed.
Yeah, based on the novel by David Mitchell. Did you see it, Tiber?
Yes, I did. And I found it really remarkable on a visual level and even a structural level, but it was one of those movies that sort of hit me over the head with its message over and over and over again, and I found myself wearied at the end. Some of the storylines I really wanted to spend more time with, and some of them I thought played less well. But it really is—it's you know, it's the Wachowski brothers and Tom Tykwer who really know how to put on a show. It was really something to see, especially on a big screen.
Well, I didn't see it, but I can tell you, if you, I think Life of Pi was hard to bring to the screen. You know, that was extraordinarily challenging. Which brings up another film. But Sarah, you wanted to add something.
Just about the difficulty of adapting complicated books to the screen, and I was thinking with Life of Pi, I really agreed with the previous caller about this, you know, the beauty of the imagery and how magical it was. But the script had us coming back in and out of an interview format or a plot device of the main character whose story this is being interviewed by a journalist and in this crappy little apartment. And every time that happened, it just really diminished the magic of the film. Like, the only thing that's more hackneyed is having the main character talk to a therapist.
And thinking about adaptations for a moment, I went with high expectations to see Anna Karenina because Tom Stoppard had done the script and the costumes in it are brilliant and everything. But it was an example, I think, of Joe Walsh trying to be Bertolt Brecht or trying to do a theatrical, self-reflexive kind of production, which just did not work for me. I don't know. What did you feel, Ty?
You know, is it possible for a director to be too smart? I think he outsmarted himself with that movie. The high concept behind it, we're going to set it on this ratty stage, which is going to represent the decaying, you know, czarist empire. It's an interesting idea, and it's brought to the screen with lush detail, and it ends up sort of taking over the movie and distracting you from the story, from the emotional content. And if you want to pull back at it and make a social comment, which I think is obviously intended, the production gets in the way of that. It's remarkable to look at, and it's wearying, and I think the actors actually get lost amidst the bric-a-brac. He's a really talented director who has a nasty habit of over-directing.
Well, what about the casting in that movie? I mean, Jude Law plays Anna's husband, and he's always been the pretty boy. By the way, a far better actor than most people, I think, give him credit for, as we saw in this recent film that he's in, which is all about drugs, supposedly.
Side effects.
But in this film, you know, I couldn't help noticing that her lover... okay, you sort of said it all. I didn't even have to say it.
I lost my
He's a boy toy. He's a boy. It's like Justin Bieber popping up in old Russia.
Yeah, I mean, where was the vitality and passion? What? You know, the kind of thing you associate with Tolstoy in that character.
Well, there has to be some reason she sacrifices everything. That's for this little nincompoop. You know, he doesn't really have any sort of sexual charge to him. Also, didn't you think, Michael, that
he rode horse as well?
The Jude Law portrayal and the way it was written, that they made that character more sympathetic than in the book.
Oh, yeah. Much more, in fact. Let me go to another caller here, though. And Oli, that's you. Good morning.
Yeah, hello. My name is Oli from Fremont.
Yes.
I'm originally from the town of Pondicherry, India. So that's where the story, The Life of Pi, started. And I've read the book as well, you know, The Life of Pi book. Actually, I have a lot of personal connections. The school where I, you know, grew up and studied, that comes from the storybook, the botanical garden, the zoo, the swimming pool, Biscayne swimming pool. So a lot of things come in the picture, and they've actually done a real good job of, you know, making it look like the real place. And also the, you know, the title song, is also, you know, from the language Tamil, which is my mother tongue. So I'm rooting for it, and I have personal connections.
Well, you got a homeboy investment. Did you like Slumdog Millionaire?
Yes.
Okay. And do you like Bollywood films generally?
Yes.
Okay, good. Good to hear from you. Thank you for the call. Let me go right to another caller, and that's Sonny from Sacramento. Good morning.
Hi. Just I had a quick question and a comment question about what did you guys think about the movie Hitchcock? I thought that was an interesting film. And the second thing was about and I think a lot of the voting in this Oscars is kind of what was said in Trainspotting, where they said it's a popularity contest. Because one year, Russell Crowe, I thought he did a better job in A Beautiful Mind versus trying to fill this. It looked like I'm a minority, so they're trying to fill the minority card by getting you know, Denzel Washington, Sidney Poitier, Halle Berry, and Whoopi Goldberg into that four-studded win. So that's what I see. I think a lot of the voting is dramatic, you know, especially like a movie like Slumdog Millionaire, which is, I think, is a more typical movie. But there are better movies in India, but here it got all this notoriety, you know. So I just those two comments and that question about Hitchcock is all I had.
All right, Sarah.
It was okay. It was okay. It had a very good performance by Helen Mirren as Hitchcock's wife. I thought the scenes between them were the best you could hope for. I mean, she's done great work, but she was those scenes were the strongest in the film. And it had some conceits. I really didn't buy Hopkins' performance as Hitchcock. I think that was one of the difficult things for me. I was surprised. I actually thought that Scarlett Johansson did a pretty handy job with the Janet Leigh character.
Yeah, and I actually thought Jessica Biel was fairly good as who's the other actress that she plays in her
Tippi
scenes?
Vera Miles.
Vera Miles. But I agree. I mean, Anthony Hopkins, I thought his performance was lost behind all that latex. I actually thought the movie was kind of grotesque to the man and to his reputation. The only scene I took out of that is the scene where he's in the theater lobby listening to the audience scream at the shower scene, and he's dancing around as if he's orchestrating it. And if the rest of the movie had been up to that level, I would have liked it a lot more.
Well, let me go to some of the emails here. This is Art, who says, hasn't the Academy diluted the value of nominations for Best Picture by expanding it to 10 films? What do you think, Tiber?
No, on the contrary. I think it does open the door. You know, it came out of a general feeling for a couple of years, this is about 5 years ago, there were movies that were being shut out. And ironically, a lot of the discussion was about big blockbuster movies that may be well-made movies, in particular The Dark Knight, I think was sort of a focal point of those discussions. But what it has done, and I think the voting process is a little messy, but I still think it opens the doors to different kinds of films. So I don't think you would have seen Amour or Beasts of the Southern Wild nominated this year if there had only been five. And I'm delighted they're in there and part of the discussion and part of the argument, and more people will see them as a result. Whether they like them or not, that's up to them. But it is casting a wider spotlight on different kinds of films, even films outside the American commercial filmmaking industry, which is a plus.
Well, apropos of that, here's Ken in Livermore. I want to read some of these emails, who writes, you have to be kidding me. Amour, a great film. That film moved slower than the old lady's illness itself. 20 minutes of watching two elders eating and cleaning themselves, the most boring movie of all time. Nothing happened. That's Ken weighing in. Thanks, Ken.
Call me in 40 years. Call me in 40 years. You know who loves that movie? You know who loves that movie? So I do a lot of speaking in the Boston area, and sometimes I speak to older groups. You would not think that people in their 70s and 80s would want to see this movie. They love Amour because it tells the truth.
Well, also because of its message about love, too, don't you think?
Absolutely. Yeah. But it lacks the usual Hollywood pieties about old age, and they are just grateful that a movie is being honest with them about the stage of their lives.
Well, I saw White Ribbon, too, which is probably why I've been girding my loins to see Amour, because that stayed with me for quite some time by the same filmmaker. Terry writes on our website, my way of seeing Moonrise Kingdom, directed by Wes Anderson, was the best picture by far. Creative, excellent writing and acting. A masterpiece.
I don't necessarily disagree with that. I think it's probably the best film he's made, and I would love to have seen it get nominated for more than, just one nomination for a screenplay?
Well, let me read some more tweets here. Seth says, if the master was Philip Seymour Hoffman and his various personnel don't take some hardware home, the world is entering a dark age. Kimberly writes, Daniel Day-Lewis deserves it, but will the Academy really give a guy his third Oscar? And we asked our listeners.
Yes,
I think he's going to get it.
We asked our listeners on Facebook for their thoughts, and John said for Best Documentary, Five Broken Cameras by Ahmed Bernat. Adam says, more relevant than the Grammy Awards, but really, who cares? More tweets. The kids and I do a home red carpet during a TV red carpet starring their stuffed animals. Amanda writes, I'm rooting for Zero Dark Thirty, Lincoln, Django Unchained, and Argo all the way. Another listener, Michael, writes on our website, in regards to Seth MacFarlane hosting the event, I can't say it's preferable to, well, anyone else. I'm on the age demographic that has perhaps seen the greatest volume of his work, and I can't say that it has warranted what I consider a higher esteem position than he perhaps deserves. Without evidence, but perhaps without bias, I had assumed he was selected to appeal to a more mainstream audience.
That's an interesting view of it.
I actually, maybe I'm a minority here, but I think he's actually going to be a great host. I think he's got just enough edge without alienating a lot of people. I think he's very smart about what he can get away with and what he can't get away with. And I think he's clever and creative. I'm actually not a huge Family Guy fan. Maybe this is because I'm from Boston. I am quite a fan of Ted, the movie. Love it or hate it. And I think I'm really looking forward to what Seth MacFarlane's going to be doing as host.
Well, we're looking forward to the Oscars, and this has been a good preview of them. And I want to extend thanks to Leonard Maltin, who was with us earlier, film critic and historian and host of Maltin on Movies for the Reels channel, and also author of the 2013 edition of Leonard Maltin's Movie Guide, which is available. Ty Burr with us, film critic from the Boston Globe. His book, Gods Like Us, on movie stardom and modern fame. Thank you, Ty, for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks to you, Sarah Wood. Always good to have you as well. Freelance arts journalist and film critic, contributor to a variety of publications, including Hollywood Reporter, San Francisco Arts Monthly, and the San Jose Mercury News, and a member of the San Francisco Film Circle, Critics Circle.
It's fun.
Fun to have you all. And again, if you're interested in the event that's going to be in Marin that I'm going to be hosting, go to the website of the California Film Institute. I might even participate in that live auction. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. Forums produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Katie Sprenger. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Our interns are Lauren Benichow, Ben Gill, Jasmine Wynn, and Nora McCartan. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, and you're listening, of course, to Les Mis, I'm Michael Krasny.
Has been gone.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.